getting this federal grant to actually have some seed money, I think will really help get this launched.
The state receives federal funds to help tribal courts. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 11th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a push to get diplomatic officials to start discussing transboundary mines.
So we want to make sure that this issue continues to be a focus of not only Alaskans, but also the State Department.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state, from Valdez, Utqiagvik, and more. Information at flyraven.com.
Today, President Trump signed into law a bill from Alaska U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan.
Let's get this done properly, huh?
The law is called Save Our Seas, and it aims to tackle the problem of plastic trash in the world's oceans. It renews the existing marine debris program for another 5 years, and it allows governors to request something like a disaster declaration, what's called a severe marine debris event, in order to get resources to clean it up. The law also encourages the executive branch to take up the problem of plastic waste internationally. Academic researchers say five nations are responsible for more than half of the plastic waste in the oceans. That's China, Indonesia, the Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam. In an Oval Office ceremony, President Trump fit that into one of his major themes, that other countries are taking advantage of the United States.
Vast, tremendous, unthinkable amount of garbage is floating right into our coast, in particular along the West Coast, and we're charged with removing it, which is a very unfair situation. It comes from other countries very far away.
Trump, touching on another theme, claimed previous administrations did nothing to take on the problem, even though the law extends a marine debris program established in the George W. Bush administration. Trump said he's already notified most of the countries responsible.
And we've notified them very strongly.
Sullivan and his wife stood beside the president, along with Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, who co-sponsored the bill. Even though Whitehouse is a Democrat and a vocal Trump critic, there was no disagreement on the new law. Sullivan took the opportunity to give kudos to the president.
And what the president said about the administration, the Trump administration, doing a great job on this, it's an underreported story, but they are really taking the lead globally. And, Mr. President, we want to thank you for
well,
that.
I want to thank you, and I want to thank Sheldon. Thank you, Commissioner Sheldon. See, we can shake hands.
Kevin Alexson works on the issue for Ocean Conservancy. He says the real value of the bill, besides continuing the marine debris program, is that it makes the executive branch take notice and address the international problem.
You know, whether that's in the context of trade negotiations, or it's in the context of international scientific collaboration, or it's in the context of foreign development assistance.
Alexson says the countries that contribute most to the problem of plastic waste in the ocean are rapidly developing and don't have adequate infrastructure for managing garbage. Alaska Congressman Don Young sponsored the House version of the bill. Association of Village Council President delegates passed only one resolution at this year's annual convention. It came from the regional nonprofit itself. Seven resolutions submitted by tribes were tabled until next year because they missed the submission deadline. Two of those tabled resolutions asked the region's tribes to oppose the proposed Donlin gold mine, which could be one of the biggest in the world if completed. That would have reversed a resolution AVCP passed in 2006 that supported the project. Napakiak and Tuntutuliak were the two tribes that submitted anti-Donlin resolutions. Donlin Gold gave a presentation about the mine at last week's AVCP convention. Donlin spokesman Kurt Parkin says the presentation focused on addressing recent concerns raised about the project. The one resolution that passed was aimed at preventing vandalism to rural airports and runways in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. The state of Alaska now has some federal funds to advance a program to use tribal courts to handle misdemeanor crimes. Alaska Attorney General Jonna Lindemuth has been working with tribal courts to create a simple process for transferring cases, known as civil diversion agreement, to enable tribal courts to handle low-level crimes in a more culturally sensitive manner. But there has been a problem. Lindemuth says the state and tribes needed more resources to get the program rolling.
Getting this federal grant to actually have some seed money, I think will really help get this launched.
Linda Muth says that what the state is doing now in rural Alaska is not working, and working with tribal courts would allow community-based remedies to be applied locally. The way the program works is that the defendants who otherwise would be charged with certain fourth-degree assaults, reckless endangerment, Class B misdemeanors, crimes involving substance abuse, and certain alcohol and drug-related offenses would be given the option to go before either a tribal court or the state court system. The tribal court can also decline to take a case and send it back to the state. Under these agreements, the state keeps safeguards in place before referring any domestic violence offenses to the tribal court. Attorney General Linda Muth compares the program to other alternative courts operating outside of tribal communities.
You may be familiar with therapeutic court, you know, or veterans court. There can be diversion from the usual criminal process to a therapeutic court. This just involves tribes who have tribal courts to set up those kinds of programs to handle low-level misdemeanors in their communities.
The Attorney General says the three-year grant provides $900,000 to do everything from conducting training to explaining how the program will work, to providing funds to tribes to implement the civil diversion agreement. She adds that villages without such courts might be able to use some of the funds to set them up.
This is really aimed at those tribes who do have tribal courts. Now, presumably, some of this money, if they don't have a tribal court, could be used to help set up a tribal court in order for them to undertake these efforts. And so, working with the state, there should be a lot of flexibility in how we use these grants to get these programs stood up statewide.
So far, two tribes have agreements with the state, the Anvik Village Tribe and the Nulato Tribal Council. Linda Muth says several tribes in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta are talking about setting up such a program in their communities. As far as expanding tribal jurisdiction to include more severe crimes, the Attorney General says that could happen.
If a tribal court gets up and running and is doing really well with these, that's something that we could consider is expanding the types of offenses that are qualify.
But right now, Alaska is just beginning this effort, and many tribes don't have these courts. Instead, offenders are routinely sent to larger communities to attend court hearings, face judgments in due time, or rehab. Alaska's elected leaders are pressing the Trump administration to take up the issue of transboundary mining. As KSTK's June Leffler reports, the renewed push comes ahead of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's visit to Canada.
Alaska's congressional delegation and Governor Bill Walker signed a joint letter urging Washington to hold Canadian mining companies responsible for any downstream impacts in Alaska.
You know, we're looking to find a way that that we can have legitimate review processes for existing mines that may be problematic.
Matt Chuckerow is a spokesman for U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan.
But also we want to make sure that this issue continues to be a focus of not only Alaskans, but also the State Department, particularly ahead of future conversations moving forward.
This message is in hopes that Pompeo will bring up the matter at a bilateral meeting he is attending in Ottawa later this month.
You know, what we've traditionally seen is we've seen a strong history of correspondence between the Department of State and the delegation. We look forward to a timely response.
Alaska's elected officials made this sort of request to the State Department before. A similar letter was written to then-Secretary of State Rex Tillerson last year.
This federal administration has been responsive, and I'm hopeful that they will continue to be.
Jill Weitz is the director of Salmon Beyond Borders, an advocacy group for protecting watersheds. She applauds Alaska's representatives for being persistent. Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott and Senator Sullivan met with Canadian officials last February. They asked the Canadian government to join Alaska in water quality testing in Southeast waters. And the Alaskan officials requested the immediate reclamation of the abandoned Tulsiquitchief mine that's leached waste for years into a tributary of the Taku River near Juneau. The diplomatic offensive comes as several mines, large and small, are moving through the permitting stages in British Columbia's prolific Golden Triangle. The rapid development has fisheries advocates worried over potential impacts downstream in Southeast Alaska. Environmentalists point to the 2014 Mount Pauley mine disaster. That's when a tailings dam failed, spilling millions of gallons of mine waste into BC's Fraser River watershed. In Wrangell, I'm June Leffler.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Nome's city manager is put on administrative leave following harassment allegations.
We felt helpless. What do you do? File a citizen's complaint? No way. That goes straight to the city manager.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Trust Fund Land Office annual fall sale is in full swing across Alaska. Revenue generated by the Trust Land Office helps fund local programs for local people. View parcels and learn more at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Nome City Manager Tom Moran resigned from his office last month after the city faced scrutiny for a perceived lack of transparency and potentially mishandled investigations in the police department. He had intended to continue work as a contract employee, but has now been placed on administrative leave after allegations of harassment were brought forward to the city council at its meeting on Monday. Moran and Mayor Richard Benneville were both absent due to travel. Moran resigned from his office in September, but said he would work as city manager until October 18th per the conditions of his contract. An emotional testimony was brought forth by Ani Shield, the music director at Nome Belts High School, during citizens' comments in which Shield claimed that Moran had harassed her personally and through text message last year. Shield says Moran appeared to be pretending to be someone else, including in messages she described as lewd.
He started to make suggestive comments using words like urges and the like.
In one message, Shield says the sender claimed to have watched her arrive home that night. A few weeks later, Shield called the number and says she received the voicemail of Tom Moran.
And that same day, we went to the troopers, as we also have a distress of the Nome police force. They indicated the city manager did nothing illegal. We felt helpless. What do you do? File a citizen's complaint? No way. That goes straight to the city manager.
According to Shield, the sequence of events took place last year before Moran's contract was renewed. KNOM reached out to Moran through email. He admitted to sending Shield messages but denied that they were harassing. Moran did admit to pretending to be someone else due to having a previous conversation with Shield about that person. He says that he thought she had his number and would know that he only meant it to be a joke. He says he believed those messages were discussed in an executive session from which he was excluded. The council voted unanimously to place Tom Moran on leave. In the email, Moran said he understands the council had to make a difficult decision. The city council voted to approve John Handelin as the acting city manager. Managers of the Anchorage Airport are looking into construction of a big new warehouse to help boost the volume of air cargo shipped through the city. Anchorage is already the world's fifth busiest cargo airport, just ahead of Dubai. More than 10 planes every day come and go from Anchorage and Shanghai, and two dozen more head to and from Chicago. They're filled with things like electronics, seafood, flowers, and fruits and vegetables. Now, the managers of the state-run airport have an idea to make things more efficient for shipping companies. If you're shipping a pallet of iPhones from Asia to the United States, you might want to stop in Anchorage to transfer the shipment to another plane. But that other plane won't arrive for 4 or 5 hours, say, so maybe it's raining. Right now, there's no place to stash those phones that's close to the area where cargo planes park. Here's Anchorage Airport Manager Jim Sazniak.
What we want to do is provide a facility where people can store stuff on a quick basis to keep things out of the elements and secure.
The airport on Thursday issued a formal invitation to companies asking them to pitch their ideas for building and operating what the airport is calling a quick cargo center. The warehouse would sit close to the cargo plane parking area, and it could even house offices for shipping companies. The airport is looking at two possible sites, one of which would be big enough for a warehouse the size of 6 football fields. Sazniak said the facility could be built with the help from the state's economic development arm, the Alaska Economic Development and Export Authority. Companies have to send letters of interest by mid-December. Author Kim Rich was just 15 years old in Anchorage when police told her that her father had been killed. Years later, while working for the Anchorage Daily News, Rich wrote about growing up with a parent immersed in Anchorage's sordid pre-pipeline underworld, which was eventually adapted into the book Johnny's Girl. Now, Rich is back in Alaska with a new memoir called, somewhat ironically, A Normal Life. She spoke with Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes and says after her father was killed, she walked away from it all.
Flash forward years later, I'm, working at the Daily News, And there were a series of incidents. There were a lot of mysteries about my dad and our life because there was never any family. And next thing I know, it was the 10th anniversary of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline is being completed. And they were having, you know, each part of the paper is going to commemorate it. And they wanted me to cover Vice. And as I joked about it at a reading the other night, I said, as if I had a specialty in this. And to make a long story short, I had a lunch with my editor to tell him what I was going to do. And then it just came to me. We were sitting down to lunch, and he asked what my idea was for my coverage. And I said, well, I was thinking of writing about my dad. And he said, we were hoping you'd say that.
And you were a fairly young reporter when that came out. Did it change your life once all that stuff was on the page?
Yeah, it changed everything. And in some ways, the changes were good, and some of them were bad. I had to leave the newsroom to meet my contract. I was under a pretty, you know, I had to produce half of a book in like 10 months. And I still had a lot of research to do. So I was probably way over my head and learning things as I was writing. It just sort of, I became an investigative reporter and I loved it. And I still love that field. And then I think the biggest change is after it was published that I decided to go to grad school at Columbia. And that changed everything for me.
And tell me about this latest book. I mean, what's happened in the time since?
This book came together. I'm not exactly sure what was the first inkling for it, but the joke I like to tell is that I figured that by the time my girls were old enough to ask me questions, I'll be senile. I mean, I'm really old to be a mom of teenagers. And so I thought I want to write down my story. I want to write down my path to motherhood, for one. And I wanted to capture the pre-digital world for my girls. And so that was primarily what it's about. It's my long journey to motherhood and a few things that happened along the way that, you know, I had a bout with early breast cancer that, thank God, it was so early. I'm 100% cured, you know, and then infertility, trying to have children. So a lot of things that a lot of people, I think, go through. And I feel like at least I have a positive message. You two could end up with triplets, then our teenager triplets.
Do you want to just explain for a second how it came to be that somebody who's had to both confront infertility and the adoption system could suddenly have ended up with three kids all at once?
One of the things, I got married in my late 30s for a second time, and we immediately, you know, said, well, we got to get moving on this starting a family thing. I think I was 37 or 38, and it ended up being a six-year journey, which seemed like forever. I had a fertility counselor say that when you're trying to have a child and things aren't going well, it's like being in the middle of a frozen lake and you can't get your footing and you just keep falling. And it is the most hopeless feeling because you don't know if it's going to end at all or end well. Eventually, we also said, well, let's look into adoption. But yeah, how it happened was literally on the day that we learned we were pregnant with twins, we also learned a birth mother had selected us, and the baby had been born that morning at 6 a.m. But literally, three at once on the same day.
Well, Kim Rich, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That was author Kim Rich speaking with Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes. Rich will be at Hearthside Books in Juneau this weekend promoting her latest book, A Normal Life.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
The Southeast Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss proposals to change federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations and other subsistence-related issues, and invites public participation at a meeting October 16th through 18th, starting at 8:30 a.m. at the Sitka Tribal Community House. More at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
The state is changing how it taxes marijuana in response to industry concerns. The current tax is $50 an ounce for any part of the bud and flower and $15 an ounce for the remainder of the plant. New rules set to take effect January 1st make distinctions between different types of bud. So-called mature bud would be taxed at $50 an ounce, while immature or abnormal buds would be taxed at $25 an ounce. The tax rate for the rest of the plant would be unchanged. Cultivators would continue paying the tax imposed when marijuana is sold or transferred from a grow facility to a retail store or product manufacturing facility. Some in the industry have sought a more extensive tax overhaul. That would require legislative action. California-based Astra Space Inc. has scheduled a commercial rocket launch at the Pacific Spaceport Complex on Kodiak Island. The Associated Press reports notices from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Alaska Aerospace Corporation indicate the launch is planned for Friday with backup dates through October 16th. Astra Space conducted a test launch at the spaceport in July that was terminated 21 seconds into the rocket's flight. Alaska Aerospace Corporation CEO Craig Campbell says the rocket was terminated before it reached its suborbital destination, but the launch is still considered successful. Crabbing in the Bering Sea starts next week. The Bristol Bay Red King Crab, Bering Sea Snow Crab, and Bering Sea Tanner Crab fisheries open on October 15th. News about population health is mixed. While snow crab stocks are on the rise, king crab and tanner crab are declining. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
The quota for Bristol Bay Red King Crab is way down. The total allowable catch is 4.3 million pounds. That's 2 million pounds less than last year, which was already the lowest TAC since 1996. Miranda Westfall is the area management biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. She said she expected the spring survey to show a decline in red king crab, but the drop was even greater than anticipated.
It's hard to determine exactly what the combination of triggers is for the declines in this stock. We believe it's probably a combination of environmental factors along with maybe something has changed, there's bycatch issues. It's hard to tell exactly what the threshold is because we can't go out and see them and count them and look at their environment since they're at the bottom of Bristol Bay.
That's a theme of our conversation. It's hard for scientists to design studies that pinpoint specific causes of crab population decline, but they can point to unusual features of the Bering Sea right now that could be stressors. Warm water, for example.
Right now, we know that the Bering Sea has been very warm for a couple years. This year, it's going to be another warm year. The environmental scientists that study Bering Sea temperatures, they're letting us know that there's not a cold pool this year. So generally, there's a cold pool that comes down through the Bering Sea and helps to structure the different populations that we have of crab and groundfish. That's not there this year. It's possible the crab could have moved, or they can't adapt to environmental stressors. It's hard to say.
The Bering Sea tanner crab is another population that's struggling. 3 years ago, the fishery did not open due to low population. Last year, the fishery's west side opened, while the east side remained closed. This year, the same will happen, with a similar quota, 2.4 million pounds for the west side only.
We're seeing a lot of old shell crab, a lot of older crab, not a lot of new shell biomass in the system right now. But there is a pulse of small, really small juveniles that'll be coming into the fishery in about 5 years. So we've got some hope coming, but right now it's sort of an aging population we're still fishing on, which is obviously declining as we fish on them.
The bright spot is the Bering Sea snow crab. Their quota of 27.5 million pounds is way up from last year.
We've got a large recruitment pulse that's just starting to come into the fishery, which is great. So we're expecting really good news for the next few years.
All three Bering Sea crab fisheries open October 15th. Bristol Bay Red King crab will remain open until January 15th. Bering Sea snow crab runs through May. Bering Sea tanner crab goes until the end of March. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
British Columbia has greenlit another gold mine in the region's prolific Golden Triangle near Hyder, Alaska. Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports.
IDM Mining CEO Rob McLeod said the 363-acre mine would be a relatively modest operation.
It's a fairly short mine life at about 5.5 years. But in 2017, we added another 20% of resources, and the deposit is wide open for expansion.
The environmental assessment approved by BC authorities envisions downstream monitoring for about 10 years after the mine closes down. Federal scientists in Juneau are concerned that's not long enough. NOAA hydrologist Sean Egan said historic mines nearby have proven it can take decades for sulfides in mine waste to oxidize in a way that generates acid drainage.
In earlier minings, they had piles of rock sitting around, and it took 20 years for the acid to really develop. the acid leaching that really come out of those piles. So the amount of time they're proposing to monitor does not seem sufficient.
Alaska regulators have also weighed in. They work with their BC counterparts because of potential downstream impacts in Alaska. Kyle Moselle is in charge of large mine projects for the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. His agency didn't find any red flags with the project.
You know, I'm not going to second guess the regulatory decision by the BC regulatory agencies on setting that 10-year post-closure monitoring period. But it's not unusual that for a short-lived mine, you would have a proportionally short monitoring period.
But Alaska-based mine watchdogs have concerns about the proposed tailing facility. That's where mine waste is stored in reservoirs. Brian Lynch is a retired Alaska Fish and Game biologist who now works for a group called Rivers Without Borders.
Tailings dams are the problem. You know, not just in the gold mines in BC, but tailings dams for coal mines in the, you know, in the U.S. It's just having those in the systems that can be problematic.
Rivers Without Borders and other green groups urged IDM to use dry stacking for its mine waste. It's like what it sounds. Water is filtered from the waste, allowing it to be stacked in dry heaps for long-term storage. It's the method used at the Hecla Greens Creek mine on Admiralty Island. But McLeod said in order to liberate the gold from the ore, it'll have to grind the material down to about 25 microns.
And so with such a fine particle size, that is not generally amenable to the dry stack method.
He said his company understands the sensitivity around tailing ponds, and IDM is still finalizing its storage plan.
We may mix the tailings in with concrete, but upon closure, it would be sealed with another geomembrane and covered up and will be continued to be monitored at the headwaters.
The Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency is doing its own separate federal review, and it's taking public comment through October 18th. IDM projects its Red Mountain mine will produce about 500,000 ounces of gold, worth nearly $600 million at today's gold prices. The company expects to begin construction in 2020. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Christy Schallenberger in Bethel, Johanna Urich, Nathaniel Herz, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, June Leffler in Wrangell, Emily Hofstetter in Nome, Avery Lill in Dillingham, and Jacob Resnick in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
What if free speech and civility could coexist? Join the University of Alaska on October 12th for a public discussion of this timely topic. The forum will feature a noon presentation by the author of the book Free Speech on Campus, Erwin Chemerinsky, as well as the Seawolf debate team, taking up the topic of whether the future of democracy depends on limiting free speech. Friday, October 12th at the UAA Fine Arts Building. The event begins at 11 a.m. For more or to live stream the forum, go to www.alaska.edu/freespeech. This message sponsored by University of Alaska.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.